Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the show. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you so much for being with us. When a play written by a German dramatist from the past eerily matches moments in present day, it is time to take note. The Classic Stage Company's production of The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy is directed by Tony Award nominee John Doyle and written in 1941. By influential playwright Bertolt Brecht during his time in exile from Nazi Germany. Doyle uses an English translation of the play with updated language from the 60s by George Tabori. Four-time Tony Award nominee Raul Esparza is Arturo Uy, and a Depression-era gangster in Chicago trying to gain control of the cauliflower trade as he unmercifully disposes of his rivals, and the community stands by and does little. The play is a satiric parable examining the ascent of Hitler before World War II. The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy is playing at the Classic Stage Company through December 22nd. And Raul Esparza is in the studio. I'm so happy to meet you.
Hi there. It's great to meet you, too.
So Arturo is this multidimensional character, a simple boy from Brooklyn, as he repeatedly tells us.
Complete with hand gestures and prayers.
Yes. When you think of him, what kind of man do you think he is?
He's pretty craven, craven and cowardly and small and neurotic. I had this image that came to me a couple of weeks into rehearsals of like a stray dog that's been kicked a lot that ends up giving a lot of love to anybody that's nice to it. Mm-hmm. And so becomes really loyal to whoever loves him. But they just didn't notice that he had rabies, you know.
Oh, bear's teeth.
Yeah. Yeah. So part of the trick with the part was balancing how much Hitler to throw in or not, and how much gangster to throw in or not. And, you know, we can certainly talk about that because there's so many different, it's like a big collage of influences on Brecht that then you take on as an actor. And yet the biggest surprise to me, looking at him at first was this thing that there was a sort of needy, neurotic, broken softness to him that I just did not expect. And that's what I think of first. And then I would say to people, oh, well, you know, he's just a fundamentally horrible human being who is, you know, pure evil. But you can't really play that as an actor.
Yeah.
So he surprised the hell out of me by revealing this this other sort of slightly craven side.
So from Arturo's point of view, what is this play about?
It's about his right to control Chicago, about, you know, dominating not just Chicago eventually, but dominating the entire eastern seaboard of the United States. He's someone who believes they have a right to rule and must rule and should control everybody's business. And
why does he think he has that right? That's what I've been trying to
get at. I think he thinks he's
a
sort of, you know, quiet genius. Mm-hmm. I think he thinks he's smarter than everybody, and he is. He's very good. I don't know if it's, you know, book smart, but it's certainly smart enough to know that how people work and how to manipulate situations. He's extraordinary at it. And then the first scene of the play that you get to really spend time with him, he seems to be almost completely shut down, and then some little nugget of information comes to him that there's an opportunity for a graft or for blackmail, and he jumps on it so fast. Part of that is a product of the way Brecht writes. Part of that is also the fact that we're speaking in verse, and verse forces you to think fast and speak fast. But it also allows me to not become a self-indulgent actor and just kind of jump on the fact that this guy thinks quick. And what he thinks quick about is ways to commit crimes and how to take advantage of situations that will allow him to control other people.
It's interesting you say verse. Does your training as a singer, because you're a fantastic singer and in musical theater, does it help you?
Yeah, I think
play,
so.
Yeah?
I totally think so.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the best actors I've seen doing classical plays tend to be people who have musical backgrounds. Because you have to speak kind of on the breath. You have to think giant thoughts for long lines of, you know, of expression. When you sing, it's partly about the breath driving you. And you have to sing before you're ready, sort of. You have to let that moment carry you. So with classical verse, what you have to do is make maybe one idea that you have is 10 phrases long. That might, one sentence might be a full paragraph. Being able to do that is something that musicals certainly lead you to. Being able to be comfortable with heightened language is something musicals lead you to. Not that all musicals have like great big giant language to them, but they certainly have big thoughts, big emotional thoughts. Otherwise you wouldn't sing.
And big sweeping.
And big
sweeps.
Totally.
Of ideas and feelings. And
even so, I run out of breath half the time doing ooey because this guy never shuts up.
Because it's so dense, how did you go about it? Did you just concentrate on the memorization of it?
You know, I never do, Allison, but I, yes, this time I did.
Yeah.
I did. Partly after 6 straight years of filming television, your brain thinks totally differently. Like, I can learn lines for, you put a TV script in front of us, any one of us filming over at SVU would probably be able to learn that scene in 5 minutes or less. Probably. We could move it really quickly. You can't do that with a play. And so that's about short-term memory. If you were to ask me what that scene was from that series, I couldn't tell you tomorrow. But I got to know this thing in a big way. And it felt like, usually I like to kind of, I want to say wet myself, sort of like dab a little bit of the part on and slowly learn it. This was too big to do that with, so I forced myself to do it by rote. And that was much harder than I expected. I forced myself to relearn how to do my sort of long-term memory thinking. And it's hard.
Different muscles.
Totally. And it's a skill set. Just like, you know, acting in front of a camera is a completely different skill set from what it's like to be on the stage. Getting these things memorized is, unfortunately, learning by rote is a very hard process because getting these things memorized is really about learning how to think, not just what you say. You've got to have a reason for what you're about to say. Mm-hmm. And early on in rehearsals, you really don't know what that is. You know?
We're talking to Raul Espars about the resistible rise of Arturo Uy. So the staging of this is sparse and dark, and there's a steel cage, and you guys are in street clothes, lots of fedoras, which we learn why, the dark reason why there are a lot of fedoras. What does a staging like that do for you as an actor? What does that make available to you?
That's a great question. It both exposes you and makes you quite vulnerable, and it also creates a situation where you have a great deal of power because you are in constant conversation with the audience. The vulnerability is that there is nothing to hide behind. Often you look for a way to create a role almost like wearing a mask, or at least I do in the theater, as though you could put something on that becomes that character, or the character can surprise you with their expression or what they wear. In this case, no, not what you wear and not how you look. So that openness leads to a sort of forced bravery where you have to sort of jump in and trust that in conversation with the audience every night, it's gonna go where it goes. And in a way, I keep saying this about the play, it's ended up playing me, or it's ended up playing us, as much as it's something that we've planned. I worry about Arturo every night. I'm so in the audience sometimes, or so completely exposed in that tiny space, that I wonder if he's going to succeed at the things he needs to succeed at. This sounds like crazy actor talk, but it is a kind of wonderful thing that you hope for, which is maybe this crazy character I'm playing will play me a little bit, you know? And this way of being in this totally spare space has allowed that to happen.
I'm for a crazy actor talk. Makes good radio, and it's interesting. You talk about being exposed, and in that small space, you're in the audience, and you've done this before in Rocky Horror,
yeah,
and in Company. There's sort of the breaking of the fourth wall. Do you ever get frightened, or do you ever come out of character if something odd happens? Because New Yorkers can be New Yorkers, and also now that people probably feel a little more familiar with you now in your career because of SVU.
Oh, they sure do. Or Hannibal's the one that really gets everybody like, woo-hoo-hoo. They show up with their flower hats.
Really?
Yeah, the
crowns.
Oh,
wow. So has that changed for you as you've become an actor who is a little more well-known?
No, because the trick is you really do want to. Let me
answer
that.
That's a two-part. There's two-part.
Okay, so wait. So yes, I have a line where I say it is the end of Law and Order. Yeah, and I worry about that, you know, being misinterpreted. That's one thing. And I know that they're there, which is tremendous because people are coming to see me do Brecht. It's Brecht, and part of that spareness you refer to, and part of its part of the way that the show is staged is what are the demands of doing Brechtian theater. Mm-hmm. That people would be exposed to this kind of theater because they've seen me on television. Wow, that's awesome. And so I know that they're there for that. And that's tremendous. There was even like a teenager who was talking to me on the street because this summer I worked on an adaptation of a Virginia Woolf novel called The Waves. We did a musical version of it up at New York Stage and Film. It was gorgeous. And here's a teenager saying, I read The Waves by Virginia Woolf. And I'm thinking, okay, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. She's watching me on television. And then this is something that she explores, or now she comes to see this German play. That's one side of it, where the being better known helps put people in the audience a little bit. The other side of it is that you try to think like the character as much as you can, so it becomes, not as a defense, but it becomes a space between you and the audience. I am very clear that the members of the audience are actually the members of the, you know, Cauliflower Trust or the mm-hmm. grocers at the rally or fellow mobsters or whatever I've decided. And it's a little bit of self-hypnosis, which is a lot of fun to play with as an actor. Your goal as an actor on stage, especially, I know this is true of camera as well, but just less obviously so, is to think like that person for a few hours, and then you don't think like that person. And I mean really think their thoughts. I mean like not know what the next words will be that are going to come out of your mouth. And what that does is it keeps the audience from just being people staring at you and judging you, because that's no longer your concern. You're just trying to behave as honestly as possible in front of people who are that close. It's what's exciting about Brechtian theater, though, you know, in part to answer the previous question even more so, is that Brecht has influenced the way we make theater in the world since he wrote in, you know, the mid-20th century, early 20th century. We're used to shows now without curtains. We're used to spaces that are kind of bare to represent a whole world. And he kind of created that idea, this constant reminder that we're watching a play. All these elements that are part of what make a Brechtian play, that experience that you see in our production, are things that have entered sort of the conversation of how we create theater in the world because of him.
Now, Brecht was not your jam, though, when you were in school.
No, I actually never, I always say I appreciate it, but didn't get it. It's like a lot of theories, but the best thing about John Doyle is that he's not interested in theories, and we never sat down to talk about how do you do this. John just gets up to work. John and I worked together on Company, however many years ago that was. And he had us rehearsing the first number for Company the very afternoon we started rehearsals. Nobody does that. Usually you sit down and you read it and talk about the play. He's not interested in that.
You went in.
You just get up and do it. And in this case, too, he talked about the set, which is this concept of a cage that potentially the audience is in as much as the actors are in. He talked about the ideas of what's happening in the detention centers at the border. And that's partly why we're also in street clothes. He talked about the fact that the cast is made up of many different colors and shapes and sizes, that it's a play that is trying to encompass what you might see on Third Avenue, you know, right outside the theater, and that it's being put on by the people who are maybe not wanted right now. Roles that are generally men's roles are being played by women. And to have a woman of color in particular being like the one voice of reason in the show, all these things were significant to him. And the image of being in a detention center defined not just the cage, but the fold-up tables and the fluorescent lights over us. Mm-hmm. And the way that we enter the space through a locked door. These are all details. He discusses them for a moment, and then we just get up and start to create. And you play with John in that you never really run the show in its entirety in rehearsals with him. You just do the scenes over and over and over and over, and every time you might make a little change to just see what happens. So what that does is it takes the onus off of you as an actor to feel like you're aiming for a result, because every rehearsal is an opportunity to play and try stuff. There's no one way to do it or get it right. That allows you to kind of stop feeling like you need to be perfect.
That's liberating.
It's really liberating.
Hugely.
He's an extraordinary director, truly.
We're speaking with Raul Esparza. The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy is running through December 22nd at Classic Stage. So there's actually some really funny physical comedy in this that then sort of turns and gets perverse and disturbing. Specifically, when Arturo is trying to learn to have a more a manner that will command respect. Uh-huh. So he's trying to learn this walk and this way of speaking and way of using his hands, and it ends up being a Nazi salute.
Uh-huh. like everything does. Yeah. If you don't know what you're doing, you always end up making a Nazi salute.
It's
like those kids in school.
It's just a crazy, funny, then really upsetting.
Awful. Yeah.
Transformation. Tell me about the development of that.
Yeah. The imagery for the play itself, that particular sequence where he's learning, comes from the fact that Hitler actually did go to an actor. And there are images online, you can find them, of photographs of Hitler in a studio, you know, like studio portrait of Hitler as, you know, firebrand, Hitler as sad, emotive leader, Hitler they're
weird
cuckoo bird pictures. And he looks insane, and his gestures are the gestures that he practiced in front of a mirror. And there was he tried to get them destroyed, but they exist, as all things do on the internet. So Brecht's whole idea here was he wanted to mock these thugs. Like, that was part of what inspired him to write this in the first place. Was he wrote it very quickly. He wrote it in 3 weeks. He wrote it on the run from the Nazis in 1941, moving up into, like, I think Norway was where he was. And he thought, you make fun of them, they're clowns. It's ridiculous that he went to go, you know, become this version of a dictator. The joke backfired both on Brecht, and it backfires on the world ultimately. And these gestures, some of them I took from the idea that I'm seeing pictures of Hitler and how his claw-shaped hand, or some of it is also coming from Brecht's favorite film actor was Chaplin. And not that I'm doing Chaplin, but that there is some of that kind of sense of clowning in it, and you just kind of go with the goofiness of it. The gesture is finished in the audience. The ominousness is not anything we're playing. You know, there's suddenly shadows on the walls that are upsetting. But all it is a space with a ghost light and someone learning to walk and hold their hand up in a particular way. It's just that the shadows on the wall suddenly make it so much more ominous. The clowns walk in the dark, becoming more and more rigid because he doesn't know what he's doing, starts to seem like a goose step. But to him, it's just a powerful new way of walking. The transformation of the character through his body surprised the hell out of me, actually. That was a real aspect of the role that, remember where I mentioned this idea that you try to put on a mask? Mm-hmm. I've always thought of that mask as something that goes on your face. Here in this case with Uy, it's been about his body and about learning his gestures and about coming up with sort of variations on Hitler or Chaplin or Cagney and the old gangster films. And that mishmash ended up becoming a mask that plays my whole body. That transformation into full dictator mode is kind of the ugly reveal for an audience that has actually had a really good time watching him learn and has been cheering him on. I'm also quite surprised by that. I'm surprised by how much the audience enjoys him. And his learning.
And also, he presents it, at least in the beginning, as a bit of an underdog, because he's kind of schlumpy and he's schleppy, and he comes in and he's bummed. Nobody pays attention to me anymore.
Yeah, I'm nobody gives him prizes.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a picture of Hitler that I saw when we were working on this at first, where he's like seated in lederhosen by the side of a canal or something with like a hat on, and his little legs are crossed and his little hands are crossed, and you're just like, oh God, what a loser. He looks like Stephen Miller, actually. He looks just like that kid that went to high school that everybody's like, ugh, him. And you think that's the guy who wants to be the leader of the country. Great.
And then it happens.
And there's another picture of him with Hindenburg in a car, and he's just got this like grimace of utter contempt and with these little beady eyes on him. And yeah, it happens, and no one's quite paying attention. There was a profile by, an extraordinary profile by a woman named Janet Flanner, who wrote in the New Yorker in 1936 in three separate parts about him, sort of, which I read. And she mentions, you know, he's got a library full of 6,000 books, but he doesn't read because what does he need to learn? And he doesn't get up until the middle of the afternoon, and then he parades around in his pajamas and his slippers. He might go into the corner and cry by himself or sit in a catatonic state, but that doesn't comfort anybody because his tears could lead to someone getting killed. That profile was such, it was a revelation to me, because it's reading about Hitler before he is this demon that we ascribe as this pure evil, and seeing him as this very small man who is grasping and a little lazy and a little and very odd. Even he describes himself as odd in the profile. He would feed mice at night in his attic by himself. That kind of thing. That guy.
That guy.
That guy. That guy. Oh, what happened to that guy?
The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uri is running through December 22nd. Before I let you go, I have two theatery questions. One is, I went to the show on the weekend, and then my producer Pilar went to see it the other night, and a light broke on stage. She came running back to me, Allison, does that happen in the play? I was like, not the day I was there.
I think it was like planned.
What happens to you as an actor when something like that happens?
Oh, it's just sheer anarchy. That everything feels like it goes off the rails. I love it. There's this sense of like something's gone off course and now we can go anywhere. That evening though, all the lights went out, so I had to stop the show and sort of acknowledge that we're now in the dark, which, you know, isn't great for watching theater. But it lets the audience into this kind of like, oh, now we're all in this together. Yeah. And it transformed the scene that followed, because the scene that followed is the rally where he's trying to get all the grocers going, and now we were doing it in work lights. And suddenly it's a whole new scene. And things that were funny were maybe not quite so funny because he's a little bit more exposed. That was that kind of stuff you live for as an actor. I've done shows where doors don't open and, you know, things fall in and you just kind of run with it. It's part of what's extraordinary about live theaters.
Yeah.
It's a conversation every night, and so it changes. But with a Brecht play, it's fantastic because your job is to constantly remind the audience that we're all in this together.
Yeah.
It's sheer anarchy. It was wildly fun.
Are we losing you to Chicago for a couple months?
Well, Chicago used to be my home. I lived there for 8 years. I'm going to be out there for a few months, sort of the end of the theater season to do Hamlet, which I'm thrilled about. It's getting to do Hamlet, first of all. And second, just getting to be home. I went to NYU here in New York. And then after I graduated, I moved to Chicago, got my equity card out there at the Goodman and worked at Steppenwolf and Victory Gardens. And it's one of the great theater cities in the world. And I think of it as the home I chose, you know. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Miami, came to school in New York, but Chicago was the place that I fell in love with. So to get to go home for a little bit, I haven't worked there as an actor in 18 years. So I'm excited. And, you know, Hamlet. Uwe and Hamlet. I think I'm going to write a book, I swear. I think there's something here.
When are we going to hear you sing again? I asked Stephen Pasquale this about a month and a half ago. I was like, I get the serious acting thing, but there's like a handful of you guys who are leading men on Broadway, like you and Andy Carr and Stephen Pasquale. Any chance?
Well, there's a possibility. There's a musical sort of circling. And I did get to go to work on Chess down at the Kennedy Center. We were looking at a production of that down at the Kennedy Center, which was wonderful to do. And it's sort of circling. It's hard. Musicals are hard. They're so hard. It's the hardest thing to do in show business, I think, doing a Broadway musical 8 times
I'm
a week.
Sure.
Oh, wow. And yet, you know, singing Being Alive in Company is like standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon. You feel like, and this is one of the great things that there is in the world. It's like being part of something so much bigger than yourself. Broadway is one of the great American art forms, and getting to sing like that in front of an audience, please, it's transcendent in a way that nothing else quite matches. So yeah, I love it. So
that's a yes.
It's a yes. It's there somewhere. I just don't have anything specific I could talk about.
The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy will be playing at the Classic Stage Company on East 13th Street through Saturday, December 22nd. Raul Esparza, it was a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for coming
so
to all of it.
Great to meet you. Thank you.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. We're back in a minute. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. If your New Year's resolution is to get organized in 2019, wouldn't it make sense to get a head start now, like an organized person would? There is one method that has a cult-like online following called the Bullet Journal Method. Joining us now is the creator of the organizing system. His name is Ryder Carroll. He's the author of the Bullet Journal Method, Track the Past, Order the Present, Design the Future. Welcome to All of It.
Thank you for having me.
And folks, if you would like to join the conversation or if you have a question, maybe you have an organizational system you'd like to share, our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Okay, so there are terms that we need to know before before we discuss this. Mental inventory, index, daily log, monthly log, rapid logging, future log. Let's start with mental inventory. What do people need to do to start this method?
Well, the mental inventory is actually just an exercise, essentially. It's designed to help us stop for a minute and just think about what it is that we're doing, the things that we're currently working on, the things that we should be working on, and the things that we want to be working on. It just gives you an opportunity to, you know, take everything out of your head and put it on paper so you can see it clearly, which is something I feel like we're doing less and less of because we're so busy and we're constantly moving forward. So the mental inventory is just that. You're taking an inventory of all the things that are distracting you, if you will.
So after you do that, do you put them in an index form? How does this work?
Well, the idea is that you just take a look at it first. It's a map, right? And then it gives you an opportunity to do something that I think is can be very helpful in us becoming more productive and focused. You start asking yourself questions of all these things, right? It's not just about hoarding all your tasks and responsibilities and goals and ambitions. It's actually about figuring out what actually matters to you, what is truly important, what your priorities are. So the first step with the mental inventory is just to declutter your mind. And it's like very much like when you're decluttering a pantry or a closet, right? Mm-hmm. You have to take everything out to see what's in there before you put back in the things that you actually want to consume. So the idea is then you have this list and then you go through it and you ask yourself, what matters? You know, what matters to you or to someone you love? It's a simple question, right?
It's kind of a deep question too, as well.
It can be.
Yeah.
But like if you have no answer for that, you know, like why does this matter, right? Does this matter? It's like, if it doesn't really inspire that, then that's something to look into. It's like, does it matter? Is it vital? So think rent, taxes. Like, what if you don't do could actually prove to be a problem for you down the line? And then a last question is like, what would happen if I just never did this? Like, ever? You know? And it's another simple question.
But it's another big question.
It
yeah.
is. And often the answer will be not much. So then you start asking yourself then like, why is it on my list? Why is it distracting me? And you very quickly start to remove things from this list because it doesn't matter. It's not vital. Nothing would happen if you didn't do it.
Yeah.
But some things come to the surface. You know, other things start to become more of a priority. Some things engage you more. And those are the things that we're always looking for with bullet journaling, the things that actually will add value to your life.
And explain why it's called bullet journaling.
A couple of reasons. One is when I was trying to formalize the system, because this just used to be the way that I operated, but it was really important for me to figure out how to teach it as best as I could. And I wanted a name that kind of represented a couple things. One is its heritage, right? You know, it's called bullet journal. So there's obviously journaling involved, but there's bullet, which implies, you know, speed, which mm-hmm. I also think is really important. I feel a lot of times people are turned off by journaling because it seems very time intensive. So the way that the bullet journal is organized is that it's designed to, you know, work at the speed of life, I like to say. Mm-hmm. So bullet journaling, the idea is that you have a list, but it's also a journal, you know, because you think of a bulleted list and
sure.
you also have journaling. So it plays on many different roles. And last but not least, also the domain was available. So
I love a practical person. Yeah. We're talking to Ryder Carroll. The name of his book is The Bullet Journal Method. It's as you say, track the past, order the present, design the future. Okay, mm-hmm. give me a way I track the past. How do I order the present and how do I design my future?
Okay. Well, tracking the past is something that we do in the present, right? As you record your experience, that becomes the past. And I think it's really important to have a record of your experience, because then you can look back and see what happened. What did you try? What worked? What didn't work? So essentially, you will start having this resource that allow you to make much more informed decisions moving forward. And you're doing this by becoming more organized in the present. You're using what you've learned and applying it into the present moment. And in the present moment, you're deciding what adds value to my life, what matters, what is vital. And those, the answers change over time as well. And as the answers change, your direction will change. Mm-hmm. I think one way to look at it is, like, a lot of bullet journaling deals with lists. It's not necessarily only about lists, but that's a big part of it. And I like to see lists as not necessarily all the stuff that I need to do, but these are all the things that I'm allowing into my life, right? Like, a list is kind of a time machine, if you will. Like, these are all the things that will become your experience. You know, they will require your time and energy. And if you do this, this will become reality eventually. So, like, my to-do list is an opportunity to make sure that I'm headed towards where I want to be. And that's just a small shift of how you actually perceive a to-do list, but it can be an incredibly impactful one. It's not just about, like, you know, buying shoes and ordering the tickets and doing these things. Like, what are the experiences that you want to allow into your life? So that's kind of how you become to, you order the present, right? And then designing the future is just another part of that, essentially, by curating your lists and making sure that you're investing your time and energy into things that actually add value to your life. You are designing the future. You can't control what will happen at the end, but at least you're setting yourself up with the best possible opportunities that you can in the present moment, right? You're making informed decisions. You're listening to yourself. You're making sure that you understand why you're doing what you're doing.
So if I want to start this, so I've got done my inventory. I see here that there's a daily log and a monthly log. Mm-hmm. How do they work in concert?
Okay. I think it might be helpful to take a step back.
One more step back, okay.
We'll talk about how the bullet journal is organized, right? Essentially, the bullet journal method is just that. It's a methodology. It's comprised of both the system and the practice. The system is what people see on Instagram and Pinterest and everything. It's the very visual aspect of that. And the system is modular. So you can think of it as a Lego set, where every single piece is designed to organize very specific information with different kinds of templates. So there are four core collections, if you will, these templates. And the daily log is just there to help as your a way to declutter your mind in real time on an ongoing basis. This is where you capture your tasks, your events, and your notes as the day goes on, so you can focus on the task at hand as opposed to being distracted by all these things racing around your head. So you have the daily log, and then you have the monthly log, which is just another opportunity for us to take a mental inventory on an ongoing basis. A lot of the practice element of the bullet journal method is about building a routine of introspection. You know, it's not about running faster on the hamster wheel or hoarding your tasks. It's about continuously moving towards the things that matter and surfacing those opportunities. So the monthly log is your monthly chance to take a step back, figure out what you want to get done that month, why you're doing it on the one hand, so you have another list. These are your priorities. And then on the other hand, you also have a calendar. And that calendar can either be used in a traditional sense where you just write down the things that you have to do. But I and a lot of the community choose to do it in a different way. We use it as a timeline. So we write things in our calendar after they've happened, right? So it gives us an overview of how our life is unfolding, which can be a tremendously impactful resource. Have you been on this diet for 3 weeks or has it been 1 week? How long?
And also it lets you look back and see about the choices you've made.
Exactly.
But did that set of choices work for me? Do they make me happy? Or that's that distinction you make in this about being productive versus being busy. Was I productive or was I just busy?
Right.
We got a call. Let's take a call. Philomena from Westchester. Hi, Philomena. On line two. Hi, Philomena.
I tend to be a fairly organized person, but I've just started a new way of getting done in a particular way what I want to get done. I have a very lengthy list, and it's obviously going to cover couple of weeks or two, but I put a color code next to it with a marker. So today happens to be black. So anything that's in black, I know I have to get done today. And I check it off. And then tomorrow morning, I'll look at the list again, and it's going to be pink. And So, and this way, I'm not looking over this 50 or 60 item list and trying to figure out what do I have to do today. I'm just scan, you know, immediately honing into the color I've chosen for that day. And it really helps just, you know, and your mind isn't racing with all the 100 things you have to do because it's on the list.
Philomena, thanks so much. This brings us to the point. You have a coded system as well.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain it to folks?
Sure. We have a lot to keep track of in our lives, and I try to simplify that as much as possible. So in the bullet journal, you keep track of the things that you are working on, the things you don't want to forget, and the things that have happened. So your tasks, events, and notes, essentially. And we do this by writing them down as very short form sentences and then giving them a bullet or a symbol, essentially, which is a dot, a circle, or a dash, so we can quickly scan our notes and see what we actually have to do and things that we can kind of reflect on later. And the idea was just to take a traditional list and kind of supercharge it with context, essentially, because a lot of times the lists we keep,
they just start looking like long strings of words together, right?
Exactly.
Things get lost and buried. So much of this to me feels like it's about mindfulness.
Yes.
Right? It's about really paying attention to what it is you want to do and how you want to do it and what meaning it's going to have in your life. Is that, when you think about it, and it's about writing it down, people do this on their phones all the time, but I know you really think that there's something about the analog method which is preferable. Why is that?
I think it helps us go offline. That is the simple answer, and I think that's really important because I think it I should say that I love technology. I was a software designer for a long time, so I fully appreciate the power and the opportunity that technology gives us. But at the same time, I also have too many times experienced it where I'm like, you know, planning out my calendar, and the next thing I know, I'm ordering shoes. You know, there's just like just no barrier there, right? And as soon as you open your notebook, like you create a space and you go offline and you're not distracted. And I think in that space, you have an opportunity to think and like catch up with your life in a way that I haven't found in any other way, you know, and you still are being productive. Like the idea that is it, with bullet journal, a lot of times it's about, you know, marrying mindfulness with productivity. The idea is like you have meditation to go offline, you know, you have yoga to go offline, but a lot of times I feel like there's an in-between space where I want to go offline just to simply think about what I'm doing, and then I still have the opportunity to take that insight and to put it into action because of the system.
Now, somebody listening to this might think, gosh, this is a lot of time. This sounds like it is very time intensive. Is it? And that's one, is it? And two, is there a better time to do this? A better time of the week, better time of the day? What do you think?
It can be time intensive if you need it to be, would be my answer. Usually it can be, you know, it can be 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes at night if you want it to be. I spend the least amount of time possible to get the results that I need, and that can be 10 minutes tops. So we have this thing in Bullet Journal called daily reflection, and that's broken into AM and PM. And the idea is in the morning, you just wake up and you look through your bullet journal. You're actually reflecting on the things that you've recorded because you think they're significant and see if they remain significant. Maybe in the morning, you know, you wrote down all this stuff, or the previous day or the previous week, you wrote down all this stuff and you realize it's not adding value. It's not that important. At the time, it may have seemed, but time has elapsed. So to the point of the never-ending list, what you're doing is you're constantly getting rid of distractions. You're taking those things off your list. You do that in the morning so you can focus on your priority through the day and kind of enter the day being prepared. And then throughout the day, you're just writing things in your notebook really quickly through, you know, the tasks, events, and notes, as I described before. And you're not really thinking in that moment. You're just recording. You're just capturing what you don't want to forget. And then in the evening, in the PM reflection, ideally, once you've turned off all your screens, you sit down with your notebook and take a moment to offload anything that's bubbled up throughout the day, something they may not have written down somewhere, and it helps you kind of relax and unwind and depressurize your mind before you go to sleep. It also gives you an opportunity to look at how much progress you've made throughout the day. You can, you know, it gives you one time where you can, in a very delicate way, celebrate, you know, in a gentle way, celebrate what you've done. You know, chances are it's very unlikely that you haven't done anything today. You may feel that way at the end of the day, but when you actually see your notebook, you have a record, you have the proof, you have the evidence, like, okay, I actually got more done. And I think that's really important because it helps correct a lot of the stories that we tend to tell ourselves. So The daily reflection can take as much or as little time as you want it to. And then throughout the day, you know, you use your bullet journal as you like it to. That being said, other people have turned bullet journaling into more of an art form or become a lot more elaborate with their systems, and they can spend a lot of time decorating their notebooks.
If you go online, you can see it all. And there's many great tutorials. There's some from you, from other people. It's really, really interesting to see how people have really taken to this, and it's really started to have real meaning in their lives. The name of it is The Bullet Journal Method: Track the Past, Order the Present, Design the Future. Ryder Carroll, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we'll get around with the latest developments in space exploration from two journalists who've been covering the topic from SpaceX to Mars. Stay with us. All of it will be back after a quick break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. The headlines of the past few weeks have been dominated by Facebook shenanigans, special prosecutors, contested elections. But something amazing happened in the past few weeks. NASA landed on Mars again. It happened on November 26th. After a harrowing journey, NASA's InSight rover landed down with a specific mission. This is just one of several new developments in space exploration. So we want to bring in Jacqueline Klimas, who's a space reporter at Politico and author of Politico Space. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great. And Rachel Feltman is a science editor at Popular Science and host of the podcast, The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week. Thanks for being in studio, Rachel.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Allison.
So, Jacqueline, let's talk about the InSight lander. InSight, it landed on Mars. There's already a couple of rovers up there. What is different about this rover? What's it going to do?
So InSight is actually not a rover.
It's not
a lander. So they really had to stick the landing in the spot they wanted it, because once it gets there, it can't move. And it's going to be studying a lot of the tectonics and seismic activity. There are sensors on it that are going to capture Mars quakes, and they're going to tell us a little more about the interior of the planet. It's already done a couple of cool things, even after just being there for a few weeks. It recorded the sound of the wind on Mars, which NASA released and people can listen to online, which is really cool. And it actually already found it's going to start doing more sorts of sending more data back in the next couple of weeks. So we should know more soon about what it's finding there.
Actually, I think we have a clip of that sound. Can we play it? I feel like I'm there. I have a really dumb question. It's funny. As I was reading through this, I just misunderstood. Explain the difference. Is a lander what it says versus a rover? The rovers are out moving around. The lander's just going to stay put. Is that the idea?
Exactly. Yeah, there are no wheels on it, no tracks on it, no way for it to move.
English major. So Rachel, Popular Science reported that InSight had a really this harrowing journey, which is called the 7 minutes of terror.
Right.
What is that?
So that's just the lander's descent protocol. You know, even if nothing went wrong, NASA was frequently referring to it as 7 minutes of terror, which just speaks to the difficulty of landing on an alien world. I think I heard one NASA engineer say we have something like a 40% success rate with landing things on Mars. You know, when we think about Opportunity and Curiosity, the rovers that have been so successful. But it's just getting something onto the surface is a huge ordeal. InSight went from 13,000 miles per hour to 5 miles per hour in the span of just 7 minutes. It endured temperatures of 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit. There was a lot that could have gone wrong, and it really did have to stick that landing, as Jacqueline was saying, because, you know, if it landed belly up, that was it. That was over. And it's really impressive that NASA made this accomplishment. It's very exciting.
Jacqueline, what do we know about what's going on in Mars' interior?
We don't know much about the interior right now. A lot of the studies that have been done so far have really been on the surface. And knowing what's under the surface is actually really interesting. That's if there's going to be water that can be used for fuel or for life support, it's likely going to be under the surface. And people have actually talked about if and when humans are living on Mars, they'll actually likely have to live under the surface in order to be protected from radiation.
Do you want to add anything to that, Rachel, in terms of what they're looking for in terms of vibrations, in terms of anything else?
Yeah, you know, one really cool fact is that the seismometer, it can detect movements of just the width of an atom. So I know, it's crazy.
I just made the blow my mind face.
So, you know, when we say that it's going to be tracking, you know, the planet's movement and activity, we don't just mean it's like keeping an ear out for, you know, the big one. It's going to hear all of the little tremors of this planet and really tell us a lot about how it's made up and how it behaves. It's really still an active world. We think of it as being kind of desolate just because it's, you know, deserty, but the planet itself still has a lot going on. And learning more about it is going to help us understand how planets form in general. You know, most of what we know comes from Earth. We have a sample size of one. So anything we learn is going to help us understand how other solar systems formed, how life may have formed on other planets. So there's a lot of really cool stuff we could pick up on.
And Jacqueline, you reported on with NASA's administrator, John, is it Bridenstine?
Is that correct? Bridenstine, yep.
Bridenstine, thank you. So he has a plan to get us back to the moon, and it links into the plans for Mars. Can you explain why NASA wants to focus on going back to the moon?
Yeah, so NASA's argument is that anything you can do to make the trip to Mars cheaper and easier and reduce the risk a little bit, we can prove a lot on the moon in terms of being able to get down to the surface with landers, being able to study the impacts on human health of living in a reduced gravity environment. If people are living and working on the moon, you'll sort of see how a human body handles being in microgravity for a long period of time. The argument is that you don't want people to spend the 9 months it will take to get to Mars and get there, and their bones are too weak to go out and actually explore. So it'll help solve or at least study those human health issues that people will face on the long trek to Mars, and just get NASA used to communicating with astronauts who are just a little bit further away. There's still not the level of communication delay there is from Mars. It can take, you know, 20 minutes one way for communication to get to Mars, depending on where the planets are in their orbit. The moon is going to be a lot less than that, but communications with the International Space Station now are almost instantaneous. So it'll help sort of build in that communications gap, and more the astronauts on the moon will have to rely more on themselves than on people at Johnson Space Center.
So Rachel, you folks over at Popular Science recently posted 7 easy ways you can tell yourself the moon landing really happened. So there are really still skeptics out there?
There are. And, you know, it's been in the news because Steph Curry, who I love, though don't love his views on the moon landing so much, he expressed some doubts. But a lot of people kind of were more shocked than they should have been. As a science reporter, you know, I hear from people on the internet all the time who think the moon landing was fake, or who even think that all of our space exploration photos of space are fake. So, you know, we periodically put out, you know, these just basic points of evidence. The thing is that if people really do believe this conspiracy that all of our space travel is made up, I can't really offer them anything because they're just not going to believe it.
Give me one example way to know.
Okay, so one common thing that's talked about in like proving the moon landing didn't happen is that if you look at photos and videos, the lighting is so, things look like backlit. Like it looks like there's Hollywood lights focused on everything, and people say like, well, where were the lights? They didn't bring lights up to the moon. But the thing is that we know from samples of moon dust that the regolith, the moon dust, is very reflective. So that lighting, that strange lighting that you see in photos and footage of the moon landing, is literally just the moon reflecting the sun back. So that's one of them. You can also literally still see the landing sites using a not that powerful telescope. You know, if you go to like an astronomy night,
you can see
they
it.
Can show you. Yeah.
Jacqueline, before we go, you reported that President Trump plans to go ahead with asking Congress to establish a Space Force. Do we know what the Space Force would be exactly? Would it be a branch of the military?
It would be a separate branch of the military on par with the Navy or Air Force. It people, I feel like people hear Space Force and they think like laser guns and aliens. It would really just be taking a lot of what the Air Force and the military more broadly is already doing in space in terms of, you know, tracking what's up there and keeping the military satellites running. It would take that all and put it under the umbrella of a Space Force. The argument for it is that it would help prioritize space in the budget instead of within the Air Force budget. There's some concern that the Air Force prioritizes planes over space assets, which is kind of their main job. So that's the argument for it. We're still waiting on the formal legislative proposal. It is going to require Congress to weigh in, but that definitely won't happen until next year. So we have a little bit of a wait and see situation.
Rachel, before I let you go in 10 seconds, this broke. Virgin Galactic reaches space and is one step closer to space tourism. Big deal or no?
Moderate deal. Important step.
All right. We'll have you back for that. Rachel Feltman, science editor at Popular Science, and Jacqueline Klimas, space reporter at Politico and author of Politico Space. Ladies, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to All of It on WNYC. We'll be right back.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.